You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future. From research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Ronit Molko, and thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. I am thrilled to welcome back Harry Nelson to the program. Today, we are talking about value-based care. Harry Nelson is a healthcare legal expert and author. His books, From Obamacare to Trump Care, Why You Should Care, and The United States of Opioids, A Prescription for Liberating a Nation in Pain, called attention to the ways in which our conversation around healthcare needs to change. Harry's day job is managing Nelson Hardiman, the largest healthcare and life sciences law firm in Los Angeles, where he has been hard at work on emerging legal issues around COVID-19 and the pandemic. Harry, I'm so thrilled to be talking to you again today.
Ronit, it's great to be back with you. I'm excited to share ideas today.
Thank you. A big topic of conversation lately, certainly in autism services, but also in other areas of healthcare, is value-based care and what it's going to look like as we move away from a model of fee-for-service to performance-based or value-based care. To introduce the topic, can you just describe how these two models of reimbursement work?
Sure. So our healthcare system until now has largely been driven by a fee-for-service model, which was really volume-based. Providers provided services, submitted claims to insurance companies or government programs, and got paid for the in conjunction with the volume of services they provided. The whole concept of value-based care has been this shift that has been underway, particularly tied to the Affordable Care Act beginning in 2010, in which we are moving from just being purely volume-based and incentivizing providers to provide as much service as possible, as many billing claims as possible, to a value-based system, which is paying attention and trying to incentivize providers on the basis of quality, outcomes, and effectiveness, essentially going from paying for the input of how much services you provide to paying for the output of how good the care you provide is. And so that's been this ongoing goal. Our system is about a decade into trying to transition that way, and it's happening everywhere, including in autism treatment.
Can you, before we talk about autism, can you give us an example of another area of healthcare where there's been a successful transition and how they're measuring performance or value in that sector?
Sure. So I think the place we saw it first was, we saw value-based care first was in the hospital systems. Those were the most obvious targets when the Affordable Care Act rolled out. So at the very beginning, we started to see new rules flowing, like actually holding hospitals accountable for hospital-acquired conditions and saying that if a patient got sick in a hospital, we weren't going to pay hospitals to take care of them. And then it extended into things like the accountable care organization model, which was an attempt to say, we're not going to just pay you we, the government, are not going to only pay Medicare claims based on how much care you provide, but we're going to give you additional upside if you can meet certain metrics to show that you're delivering high quality care and getting good outcomes. So we started to see the beginning of programs that were not holding out a stick, a punishment for bad care, but also that model was very much on giving a financial upside initially for good care, and then eventually also bringing risk into the equation so that there would be downside for inefficient care. And then the last example I would use would be on things like bundled payment. That was a big, in the Obama administration, we saw the rollout of a number of bundled payment programs, one for cardiovascular treatment, one for hips and knees, which we're really trying to wrap together all of the care needed after somebody underwent a hip replacement, for example, and say, we're going to pay one lump sum and we're going to expect that to cover everything, the physical therapy, the medical care. We're going to bundle the payment. And we started to see a rollout of those claims, but with the change of presidential administrations, we saw different policies and a lot of those programs stopped. And now, as we start a new presidential administration, we're seeing a new rollout and those programs sort of gain momentum again.
So not to get too in the weeds from a medical perspective, but with things like the absence of a secondary infection in hospital, would that be considered like a measure of quality or a measure of good care?
Yeah, absolutely. That was an example of paying attention to a measure of problems in care, of low quality care, and basically the government as the payer saying, we are not going to fund that anymore. So I consider that to be squarely an example of value-based care.
Has this also contributed to hospitals, you know, discharging people really quickly after surgery?
So
do you think that's unrelated?
Yeah, no, I think it's all part of the same thing. I guess the way I think about it is before the Affordable Care Act, hospitals had very much the same economics as hotels. If you kept your hospital census at a certain level, you knew that you were going to be profitable. And it was that simple. It was a much easier business model. And then what we started to see with these kind of with these and with other policies coming in was that it became much trickier, and government wanted to pay attention to whether people needed to be in the hospital. They started to get worried about the revolving door between, for example, hospitals and nursing homes or rehab facilities, where people weren't actually getting better, and we weren't holding hospitals and nursing homes responsible when they were just kind of going through the motions and not keeping people healthy. And your example is exactly right. The whole issue of patients getting discharged too quickly was an example of really not solving a problem and creating something that was ultimately going to be more expensive. The hospital would not just get a nice admission and then once when the person came in and then a second time when they came back, but instead there would be, it would all be sort of one thing, and there would be actually penalties for sloppy care and rewards for actually providing good care.
Makes a lot of sense. Thank you. So when we talk about the transition to value-based care in autism, how do you see that playing out?
So, I think autism has been a unique area. I think it's happening very slowly. So if we compare, for example, the way that value-based care is moving in, for example, diabetes treatment or heart disease, I think it was much easier. I think that in general, I should say upfront, I don't think that this change in any area of healthcare is like an overnight change. It's an incremental thing. And I think in autism care, we're very much in the beginning. And I think some of the challenges are the nature of autism doesn't lend itself as easily as, say, heart disease or hip replacements to value-based models. So I think it's just moving a little bit slower, a little more incrementally, but we can definitely see evidence that the model is here and is in process.
So, I mean, we'll talk about data later, I'm assuming, but that's a big piece, right? It's much easier to evaluate if a hip replacement was successful than all the variables were balancing in autism services.
Exactly. So I think, right, it's very easy to come up with very clear metrics that establish how sick a patient is when they have a hip that needs to be replaced, and to measure what their improvement is. We can very easily measure their ability to move and to function without pain. And that's a much easier thing than autism. I think the nature of autism in general as a behavioral condition, and even among all behavioral health conditions, comparing autism to mental health, to depression or anxiety or to addiction treatment, other areas of behavioral health, autism is uniquely complex. And I think we're still very much at a developmental phase of understanding it as a condition and understanding how to treat it effectively. And so I think those are big challenges that are making this transition to value-based care harder for the autism community.
All right. So what do you see the long-term future looking like in terms of the payment methods for the models?
So I think that in the long term, we're going to see classic value-based models, things like bundled payment, incentives for quality of care, ultimately risk-bearing models, which is where value-based care is going, where the parties providing the care are actually at risk when they are inefficient or when their quality is lower. I think those are all coming. I just think that they are years away, and that so they're kind of on the horizon. And what we see now is payers really trying to get their hands around some of the basic issues of how we measure outcomes, how we measure efficiency, and trying to build strong relationships with the providers who are doing the best at moving to that kind of a model.
So what will the transition look like? I mean, what do you think it's going to look like a year from now, 3 years from now? I mean, how do providers prepare for this?
So I think we're already seeing examples, Ronit, I'll tell you, I moderated a panel with a number of payers, I don't know if you remember, at one of your autism investor summits, and it was really interesting to listen to the key point people at all of these large plans talk about it. And the number one thing that we're seeing today is the growth of preferred provider relationships, meaning that payers are giving preferential status to providers who are meeting, who are showing competency and proficiency on with respect to value-based models. So when I say that, I think they are driving more patients to those contracted providers in general. They are giving, in some cases, preferential rates, and they are, you know, really much more interested in engaging with the providers who are clearly able to provide the metrics that they're looking for.
So that speaks to some of the challenges in moving forward, right? Because metrics and quantifying this is really difficult. Do you think this will be determined by the providers who will ultimately provide the metrics, or do you think the payers are going to want to dictate how that happens?
I think there's a give and take. I think it's both, right? I think we have some level, the provider community is in some ways driving the sort of industry standards, if you will, benchmarks, and kind of developing standardized quality measures, which make it a much better system to work in. And at the same time, the payers, we've seen a number of the payers be particularly assertive in putting out their own specific quality measures, you know, by which they want providers to establish that they are high quality providers. So I think there's some give and take here. I think that it benefits the provider community when the standards are driven by clinical evidence and driven by the research rather than by payers' priorities.
So I think to get to that, we have to back up a little bit, right? Because it starts with how do you quantify autism spectrum disorder, right? And so what are some of the challenges there?
Right. So that's a really big question. And I should say I answer this question with some trepidation just because I sometimes feel like, I know a lot about healthcare regulatory and reimbursement issues, but I know very little about the underlying conditions. But I'll, with that disclaimer, I would say that I think it's very difficult to quantify autism spectrum disorder as a condition in terms of its severity. I think it's difficult to quantify improvement and treatment effectiveness. I think that, you know, autism is, this is true of all behavioral conditions in general, but particularly with respect to autism, you're trying to measure impairments in social interaction and communication and behavioral functioning that are very different kind of, naturally quantifiable conditions. And I think that frankly, it's an issue that we don't fully understand the nature of how autism begins and where it comes from. And there's a certain heterogeneity to and severity level. So we have like some people who have more narrow focused symptoms, and some that are more comprehensive. We have a whole spectrum of issues of language delay and intellectual disability. We're still struggling to really with fully diagnosing it. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that autism has come on so strong in the last decades is that we've gotten much better at identifying it, but we still have a way to go. So I think that's the first issue. And then the second issue, that's really sort of getting to the nature of the condition. But then the other big issue is, how do we really identify the treatment? And I think, I think ABA has stood out as because it's been one of the few effective models, but one of the major pieces of value-based care is integrating multiple models, right? We're looking at how do we integrate medical models and social or behavioral models, and also looking at lower cost social determinants. So for example, when we look at how value-based care is going to drive diabetes, we're going to see a lot of emphasis on preventative models. How do we address diet and exercise earlier in life so that people don't get to become diabetic? It's hard to think of how that actually applies in autism spectrum disorders, right? I think that the pharmaceutical industry is clearly going to be pushing to be part of the answer. And I think we're really still at a point where we don't have any approved medication that's really specifically for autism. We have problems with side effects with a lot of medications. So we have the medical community interested and the pharmaceutical community interested in being a part of the picture with ABA. And that may not be great news to the ABA community, right? But right, it's, right. I'm reminded, I read a great New Yorker article probably more than a decade ago about, you know, all the different treatments for prostate cancer. If you go to an oncologist, if you go to a urologist, and the line that I came away with from the article was, if you walk around with a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And so, so if you're talking to somebody at a large pharmaceutical, or you're talking to a physician, or you're talking to somebody who's a BCBA, you're going to get very different opinions on what care looks like. And I think those are all ultimately going to be pieces of the puzzle in a value-based model.
Yeah. So to speak to that a little bit, because I think you're right about a lot of those things. One of the things we do know from research and from data in autism services is that early intervention is critical, because if you can intervene with a child as early as, 4 or 5 months, when you start to see those initial signs, you can really change the trajectory of development. And, we did a small study at AST years ago, which we worked with about 40 children that were identified to be at risk because they were siblings of kids who were diagnosed with autism, and more than 50% no longer met the criteria for the diagnosis at 3 years old. And the majority of the kids landed up being in regular preschool programs. So we do know that very early intervention can work. As you know, it's expensive. It can run $50,000, $60,000 a year if you don't have insurance, right? Some families just don't have access. And one of the big things we know is that the average age at which a child gets diagnosed now is about 4.5 years old. And in low income, lower socioeconomic areas, it's 8 years old. So until we have equal access to diagnosis and to intervention at an early age, it's very difficult to impact that, right? So there are all those factors at play.
Right. You touched on a couple of really important things. First of all, you touched on an equity issue, which is that there's a real unequal access to care. And we see that lower income communities, marginalized communities, communities of color are getting much less access to care. A big principle underlying value-based care is that we need to deliver quality care to many more people and many more communities that aren't getting it. And so part of the issue is cost, which you touched on. And I think this is where there's a big problem, because when I wrote From Obamacare to Trump Care, the number I believe we used in the book was, at that time, the American healthcare system was spending about $8,200+ for every man, woman, and child in the United States. I think that number is now up to 9,000 or higher per person. And so we have the most expensive system in the country. And so just to put it in perspective, when you talk about $50,000 or $60,000 for the kids who are getting the most intensive therapy and probably getting the best results from it, that is sort of, I'm not a mathematician, but I think 6x or 6 or 7 times what we're spending per person. So that is not music to the ears of the people who are paying for healthcare. And the big challenge is, how do we, if we can find early intervention models that will make care not only more accessible, but more affordable, that will really achieve great results in those early years and either reduce the long-term costs or that might be a solution. The other possibility that and the one thing we didn't touch on that I would point out is, I think that setting of care is really important, right? So one of the things that value-based care emphasizes is social determinants of care, which translates to, where else besides the doctor's office can care be provided? So like, what kind of care can be provided in schools, in the educational setting, in home? And I think that we're going to see, I do think that early intervention seems to be incredibly promising, but I think we're going to see pressure not only to get that in, ABA treatment providers, but also to get resources so that some of that is happening, in home, in school, and that those resources are better distributed across our system.
Yeah. And as you speak to cost, I mean, we understand that it's very expensive, potentially $50,000, $60,000 a year for a child for the first 5 years of life, maybe 2 to 3 years of life. But we know that the lifetime cost for an individual with autism is around $2.3 million for care. And so I think if you weigh that against, if we provide a lot of this early intervention, how does that decrease that lifetime cost for somebody who hasn't received services, can't live as independently, cannot have employment, can't have intimate relationships, and the burden of care on for those individuals right? I don't know how much of that analysis has been done. And I don't know that insurance companies necessarily or payers necessarily care as much about reducing the lifetime cost if it's not on them. But that is a consideration.
Those are big questions you're asking, and you're asking all the right questions. I think insurance companies are thinking about it, although they have to meet bottom line objectives. I remember I heard, you know, from somebody at one of the large California plans, at Blue Shield of California, I heard in the early days of the Affordable Care Act, some of their planning and assumptions were off and translated to the person who I talked to said by over $900 million in one of the early years of the program. And so no matter how much like forward long-term thinking a plan is doing about lifetime costs and efficiency, the insurance companies still are driven by bottom line imperatives and they need to spread out resources. You know, part of what I think is going to happen is I think autism seems to be one of the places where we don't have good tools in the arsenal. So if I compare it, for example, to substance use disorder treatment, like we can see actively a lot of pressure by payers to reduce the acuity of the need for care being provided in high acuity settings. So we're seeing more pressure to get people out of residential treatment programs and into outpatient and more care delivered by telehealth. And so I think what's going to happen is, you know, I think autism is one of those areas where the high intensity care is likely to continue to be available because we have so few other options. I just think that, you know, families struggling with this issue are going to need to be very aggressive, and we're going to see that equity issue continue to play out, and providers are going to need to be really pressing on it because it's going to be a challenge but it's one that I think ultimately providers and patients will prevail on.
How is this going to affect out-of-network providers? Because I know certainly there are some people, you know, getting into autism services who are focused on an out-of-network provider network, payer network, because they're getting reimbursed at a higher rate. But I would imagine that value-based care is going to impact that.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's funny. I'm afraid to declare a eulogy for out-of-network care. Out-of-network care has been with us a long time. I remember in the early days of the Affordable Care Act, I remember when it first came out and I was giving talks, I remember giving a talk to a group of surgeons and surgery center owners and warning them that the end was coming for out-of-network and they needed to get in-network. And anybody who followed my advice at that time would have been making a mistake, because out-of-network has endured in our system. That has been despite the effort of payers to make it a less and less attractive space to be. So I think there's no question that the payers are, you know, committed in terms of their cost control to make it an increasingly challenging position for providers to stay. Payers in a value-based model want to work with contracted providers who are meeting all of their standards and getting back to that whole issue we talked about with quality metrics and providing that data, and are very leery of out-of-network providers. So I think it's just going to be an increasingly challenging place to stay. I think that the insurance companies are going to consistently try to ratchet down reimbursement and do more auditing and more putting constraints and making out-of-network an unattractive place for providers to be.
What are we likely to see in the future as this rolls out?
So we talked a little bit about interdisciplinary approaches, right? I think what that's really where value-based care is going is better coordination of care among medical doctors, the therapists, you know, who might be providing occupational or physical therapy in particular cases, and ABA. I think we're going to see, you know, the nature of value-based care is to see care coordination, care management, and an interdisciplinary approach. So I think we're going to see that. That's where I think things are going in the long term. In the short term, I think we're going to see a lot more pressure on providers to be collecting data to demonstrate their outcomes, to really be able to demonstrate the acuity level and the specific conditions of the patients that they're treating, of the children that they're working with, and their results, right? And I think I think we're going to see a lot of pressure on better more documentation of quality. I think the next decade is going to be very interesting to see how much, you know, the system stays the same in terms of payers still ultimately bearing the weight of risk, or how much, you know, we see the value-based transition to more risk bearing, either by smaller providers or as I suspect by health systems. So that's one of my hypotheses, is that the health system is going to be much more of the center. The health systems will accept risk, more risk from government programs and from payers. And I think that behavioral health is going to be changed by that, meaning that but that providers in the future, I think, will need to really be thinking strategically about who they're aligned with and how they're participating and how they're integrating care. Because otherwise, if we have a system where it's all solo, siloed, providers of different kinds of care, the ABA providers are completely separate from the medical providers and separate from therapy providers, then I think it gets very hard to integrate and measure across all settings. What we notice is payers are very interested in seeing, how the doctor describes the patient, how the physical therapist describes the patient, how the ABA provider describes the patient. And it's a problem when the descriptions don't match up, right? I saw this, just to use an example from a different setting, it was very interesting. I was doing work years ago for a skilled nursing facility. And what we noticed was in the hospital, as patients were leaving, the doctors and nurses were very, were constantly wanting to describe the patient as being in a better condition so that they could discharge them safely. And then when the patient was showing up in the nursing home, the people doing the discharge were documenting at length how sick the patient was. And then when they showed up at the doctor's office, it was yet another description and not quite as sick as they had been at the nursing home. And it was a problem, because when payers are looking at these different perspectives on the same patient, and saying, it really is this, does this person have severe COPD? Can this person really not ambulate as they walked into the doctor's office? It was started to give payers opportunities to question providers. And I think that's where value-based care is going to be very important for providers to start really, being more and more precise about how patients are doing and how they're improving, and to be aligning with each other more.
So, that's a great example. When you talk about bundled payment, are you saying that the payer could say to the provider, you get X amount of dollars for 6 months, and at the end of the 6 months, you have to demonstrate that the child has mastered 50 goals, can have one peer playing with them on a play date, can go into the community with mom to the grocery store and not have a meltdown? Do you think they'll be that specific around the kind of things they want to see? Or I think it's really interesting how we're going to measure this.
I think, yeah, that's a big question. I think it's we're a long, long way. I think we're decades away from that kind of specificity. But I think that's where, I think the system is headed in that direction in terms of wanting to measure improvement and come up with some metrics that stand in for that point, and also look across patient populations at how particular providers are doing. So I think that I don't think we're going to get to that level of specificity anytime soon, but I do think that's where the system is heading.
So if I'm operating a service provider in autism, what steps can I take? What are three or four things I can do now to kind of start preparing my organization for this?
So we've talked a little bit about data, collecting data to establish outcomes and efficiency. I think that's really important. I think that we're seeing a real move in the industry towards more quality metrics. And I think being a provider who is who's collecting that data and able to demonstrate that you are applying and doing well, whether it's with standardized quality metrics or with payer-specific metrics, I think that's very important. I think that ties into, one of the things we've seen that's been critical to setting up value-based systems is interoperable records, right? So that's being able to have a record that integrates into other provider records, for example, to have your records integrate into the patient's record in medical settings, and to create that kind of 360-degree visibility through interoperable records is really important. And if I had to pick one other thing, I think I would say that you know, providers should be focusing really on quality. I think strong clinical leadership is absolutely critical. That's where value-based care is starting with quality, right? The second piece is of outcomes, better outcomes, and efficiency is sort of the second piece of the puzzle. But the road to success has to begin with demonstrating that you are providing exceptional, superior quality. And I don't think that I think you can only do that as a provider if you have really strong clinical leadership who can engage with payers and really participate in the process of making that case. So those would probably be the three things I would focus on most for providers.
I think, you make such a great point there, that I've done quite a bit of consulting in ABA over the last 6 years, and the variability around quality is immense. Not all ABA is the same. There's a lot of really bad ABA out there. There's some really good ABA, but there's a huge amount of variability. I don't know the payers yet understand how to measure that exactly or assess that. And there are a lot of companies that use a very cookie cutter approach. They don't tailor and individualize programs. They're not looking at the family as a whole, as the child specifically. So I love that point about clinical quality, because you're right. That's exactly where it starts. The clinical leader at the top, and that, focus on quality and customization that infiltrates throughout the organization.
I think, you make a great point. I have meetings occasionally with the investors or the non-clinician founders who are, very interested in a particular opportunity. I've had it in the autism context. I have it in the telehealth context, in the behavioral health context, in other areas. And then I have other meetings that are with clinicians who are really focused on doing something transformative. And those are such different meetings. And I always know it's a warning sign for me if in the initial conversations, I'm the smartest guy in the room on the clinical issues. That's always like a bad sign. Like if your lawyer is the one who's got to give you the clinical structure, I can pat myself on the back and for knowing a little something, but as they say, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. And the programs that are really doing well are ones that have a clinician in a key leadership role driving strategy and focused obsessively on quality.
Well, thanks, Harry. I have one question before we sign off today. Telehealth, is it here to stay? Is it here to stay as much as it's been this year through COVID? And how's that changing how we think about treatment and healthcare?
Yeah, I think that telehealth is here to stay. We've seen some drop off, by the way, from the early days of the pandemic in terms of utilization. It's clear that there are some patients and some providers who don't want to use telehealth. We found, by the way, telehealth in the autism setting is challenging because it really, it limits it much more to, parent education and changes the role. It's very hard as a provider to be in the room with the child. But I can tell you what we're seeing in other parts of behavioral health is just an explosive growth in telehealth that seems to be consumer-driven and provider driven. I can tell you in the area of addressing like suicidality, we're seeing an addiction. We're seeing just, enormous growth that's driven by both consumer demand, more people having access to more care, and providers who are have come to appreciate it. So I think it is here to stay. I think it's, and I also think, by the way, when we talk about value-based care, it is very much part of, it's a solution that gets us to more access to care for more people. It may not be, the highest quality interaction, but there are a lot of, times and settings in which it's the only option. And so I think we're going to see really robust continued growth in telehealth. I think we've seen, just a permanent change in our system on that respect.
Well, thank you, Harry. I always love talking to you. You're just a wealth of information and knowledge, and it's so fantastic to get some of that. So I really appreciate you taking the time. I know how super busy you are.
No, I'm honored to come on, Ronit. I think you're doing really important work yourself, and excited to always be in to continue our dialogue and support and have a chance to talk to the autism community through you. So thank you.
Thanks, Harry.
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire podcast with Dr. Ronit Mulco. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week.